You are listening to Eastside Radio Podcast.
89.7 FM, Eastside Radio.
Well, today on Monday Drive, I'm extraordinarily pleased to be able to chat live in the studio with one of Australia's most remarkable cultural leaders, composers, sopranos, educators, and Yorta Yorta women. For more than three decades, my guest has been at the forefront of the nation's classical music scene, not only through her own extraordinary performances, but also through her visionary work as a composer, and as an advocate for First Nations voices in the arts. Her body of work includes chamber, orchestral, operatic compositions that speak powerfully to Australia's history and contemporary identity. Among her most significant compositions is Eumerala, a war requiem for peace, which brought to life the untold story of the frontier conflicts in southwest Victoria, sung entirely in the Gunditjmara language. Through this and many other works, my guest has invited audiences to listen, to reflect, to begin their journey of truth-telling and reconciliation through music. To go through her awards, her post-nominals, recognitions would take far longer than I have on this program, but in recognition of her contributions, she's been honoured with an Officer of the Order of Australia and was appointed the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra's First Nations Creative Chair. Professor Deborah Cheatham-Fraylon, welcome to Monday Drive.
Alan, that's very kind. It's so lovely to be here with you.
Isn't it a wonderful day you picked to come into the studio?
I know, and thank you for this late time slot so I could enjoy as much of the sunshine as I have.
Well, it's a pleasure. It's always nice to be out in the sun. Deborah, many of our listeners will know you as a celebrated soprano, a composer, and an educator. But how would you choose to introduce yourself?
Well, it's interesting, Alan. I guess in our lives we wear many hats. And you mentioned the creative chair at Melbourne Symphony Orchestra, but I'm also chair of vocal studies at the Sydney Conservatorium of Music. In fact, the inaugural Elizabeth Todd chair of vocal studies, and that was a great honour to be appointed in that position, coming back to my alma mater after many years, and making a contribution there. A very esteemed vocal staff on hand at the conservatorium, and I've been able to work alongside my colleagues there to make a contribution. But, you know, you mentioned some of the career trajectories I've had as a composer and as artistic director of Short Black Opera.
Ah, yes, I was going to talk about that later, but carry on.
But, you know, one of the... For me, one of these sort of arduous tasks, I talk about first world problems, but one of the challenges I always have is this notion of updating your bio. Can we have your latest bio? Can we have something that's 100 words or 25? Or no, we've got space for 300 words. There's always a constant revision of the bio, this thing. And after so many years of doing this and getting, quite frankly, a little bit tired of updating the bio, I decided to really have a think about, to distill down to just the essence of what are the things that really define me. And when I walked into the studio and you mentioned that you'd come across this bio and, you know, would I refer to it? And I do, because I think it's really important to be able to distill in one's life what are the really meaningful, I guess, points of connection with your fellow humans, with society in general. But really it came down to this for me, that, you know, I'm living here in the 21st century in an urban environment. But I was born as a Yorta Yorta woman, and for people who might not be so familiar with Yorta Yorta, it's a First Nations community that straddles both sides of the border, southern New South Wales, northern Victoria, and the river that runs through it. Of course, more recently we know that as the Murray, but for the Yorta Yorta people, it's always been known as Dangala. So I come from Yorta Yorta country on my mother's side. It's a matrilineal heritage, so I call myself a 21st century urban woman who is Yorta Yorta by birth.
Right.
But, of course, I am a member of the Stolen Generations, so Stolen Generation by government policy. Soprano, as you mentioned, there's only one way to do that, be as diligent as you possibly can. And composer by necessity. That might be a bit of a curveball. Why is it so necessary to be a composer? Well, as all those other things I'd already described in the bio, the short distilled bio, there weren't so many people who fit that category composing classical music. So I felt that I had something to say, and I felt that the best language I could use is the one that I've immersed myself in my entire life. It's the one community that I've belonged to my entire life, and that is the community of musicians, of music makers. So composer by necessity and lesbian by practice. I mean, let's face it, if you want to do anything well, you need to practice. So
I was wondering whether you were going to give that part of the description. there you go. 21st century urban woman who is Yorta Yorta by birth, stolen generation by government policy, soprano by diligence, composer by necessity, and lesbian by practice. How very welcome you are into the Eastside Radio studios. You've had a hugely varied and rich career. What drew you to music in the first place? And in particular to opera and composition, as opposed to simply picking up a violin or playing a piano?
Well, I think, Alan, you know, that music is a part of our lives, no matter who we are, whether we're conscious of that or whether it's something that affects us on a subconscious level. For me, I've always been really conscious of the effect that music is having on me, and wanting to connect to it and wanting to understand it from a very young age. In fact, I think my my very earliest memory is of leaning up against my mother in church, as it happens, and her singing a hymn, and I can feel the breath in and the breath out and the vibration of her voice. It's a really, it's a visceral memory, actually. And I feel that all along music was calling me for various reasons and to various eventualities. But you mentioned falling in love with opera, and I can quote absolutely the day, the time, the place. It was the 19th of February, 1979.
Wow.
And I was sitting in the concert hall of the Sydney Opera House, and there was a beautiful Kirsten Fredrickson Belle Epoque version of Leha's The Merry Widow. Mm-hmm. And in the title role was Dame Joan Sutherland.
Aha, uh-huh, that's right.
In the pit, of course, her partner in music and life, Maestro Richard Bonning.
Yes.
And on stage, some of the great stars of the Australian opera, as it was known. But really, that night, Alan, it changed the course of my life, and I think I'm pretty safe to say the course of a number of people's lives, given what I've gone on to devote my time to through Short Black Opera, and we'll talk about the company in a minute, I'm sure. But that night in 1979, it was one of those, I'm sure, you know, listening, you will have shared an experience like this at some point where you discover something, you think, where has this been all my life? How has this existed and I didn't know about it? And up until that night in 1979, I didn't really know what opera was until I went along and experienced it.
Well, your experience with Joan Sutherland in 1979 is a far cry from hearing that church music when you started off. So somewhere in between those was the Short Black Opera, wasn't it?
Short Black Opera has come later in life. So my first experience of opera was when I was just 14 years old. So I was still a schoolgirl, and I was very fortunate to have at my, you know, my local high school, just a comprehensive high school, Penshurst Girls High in the southern suburbs, to have a wonderful music teacher, Jennifer King. Also her husband worked at the school as well, Lionel. He was head of social sciences, and together they championed opportunities for students to have some extracurricular activities in terms of going to see concerts and plays and, in this case, an opera. And really that 1979 experience sparked my interest in opera, and really from that moment on, that's all I wanted to be. But a lot of things stood in the way, Alan, a lot of things stood in the way before I would have any kind of meaningful career in classical music. But it was a great start at that school to have that wonderful mentor, in fact, a lifelong friend, as it turns out, to champion my early studies. And then, as I mentioned, I was a student at the Sydney Conservatorium of Music, and I had an opportunity to travel overseas as well and study at Juilliard School in New York, and have some wonderful experiences that, if I'm totally honest, that experience to go overseas and to examine what I knew and what I didn't know, really it taught me a lot about what I didn't know. Mm. Came back, decided, you know what, I am just going to absolutely devote myself to classical music now. I'd had a career already as a high school music teacher when I graduated from the conservatorium. And it was after that that I really just decided that not only did I want to devote my time and effort to this career for myself, that I wanted to make sure that others had that opportunity as well, others from, in particular, First Nations communities.
Right, there's a missing link I'm seeing here, and all those early influences and the Joan Sutherland experiences, your overseas experience, that's all fine, and your school experiences particularly, but your music tells stories, and they lean on your heritage. But that wasn't what you were getting from those early influences, was it?
No, not my First Nations heritage. No, as a member of the Stolen Generations, I grew up without really understanding anything about that. But I think I always had an appreciation for music that told a story or that had a strong narrative. I think, I don't know, I'm going out on a limb here, but I think much of the world's great music is that which does have a strong narrative. And even in music that you might consider to be completely abstract, if there is such a thing, the listener brings their story, brings their experience, brings whatever they're going through at that particular time, and that becomes the narrative. So I think music has this capacity for the strong story, the strong narrative. And you're right, the missing link for me was a full understanding of my own identity. I come from, in my Aboriginal family, in my Yorta Yorta family, really strong music heritage. My mother, Monica, was one of seven. She was the youngest of seven children. The eldest was a legend of the Australian music scene, Jimmy Little. And some listeners will remember Jimmy or have heard of him by reputation, but he certainly was a pioneer in the late 50s and the 1960s, in the 70s. And then after a hiatus, he came back with a vengeance in the 90s and had a revival of sorts in his Messenger release. That album was incredible. So I came from this heritage, even though I didn't grow up with these people, even though I was denied access to them, that ability and that understanding of the world and art, the understanding of the world through music and the arts more generally is just embedded in my DNA.
And and similarly, your connection to the earth. Talk to us about your connection to the earth and association with Gustav Holst's works.
Well, on a personal level, connection to the earth, the way I understand it is that we belong to the land much more than it can ever belong to us. And this is an understanding that many people around the world share, and certainly First Nations people of this land. A couple of years ago, the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra commissioned me to write a short movement of just 8 minutes in length that would complement the seven movements of Gustav Holst's Planet Suite. Of course, Gustav Holst's Planet Suite is, you know, it's astrological in its focus. It's not meant to be a study of astronomy per se, and so the fact that Earth was missing from that suite was never a problem for anybody, certainly not me. But the idea of adding our own planet to that rounded out sort of understanding of our solar system was it was a huge pleasure. And I travelled overseas to write this work. My wife, Nicolette Frayon, was conducting the National Ballet in Oslo, as it happens, and we were there for 2 months in the deep, deep snow of February in Oslo, minus 26 degrees it was.
Goodness
the day
gracious.
We arrived. But something about that environment, and you talk about Earth and, you know, your perception, your connection, something about that environment, which was so very different from anything I'd known here in Australia, it really spoke to me, and it sort of unleashed this work, Earth. And also,
how long did it take you to put together?
Well, a record time, I have to say. I like ideas to bubble away and ferment, if that's a proper use of that word. In this case, I think I wrote the entire work in about 3 weeks, which is quite a record for me.
It's got a bit of drama to it, hasn't it?
Yeah, the MSO in fine form there with Jaime Martin.
That's right. That's right. I think if we listen to all of your music, we could do that in a program, but it wouldn't leave much time to have a further chat with you. I want to talk about the upcoming concert, A Child of Our Time. Mm. It's in the Concert Hall of the Sydney Opera House this Saturday. That's the 13th of September. And you're going to be performing alongside Teddy Tahu Rhodes, whom we interviewed here in this studio a little while ago, Sian Sharp, Helen Sherman and Nicholas Jones. They're all performing with a choir of over 500 singers and a full orchestra.
It's incredible, isn't it?
It's extraordinary. Under Brett Weimark's direction. Brett was here just 2 weeks ago and we were having a chat at that stage as well. What role are you performing in that particular concert that's this Saturday coming?
So there are four soloists in the Tippett work, A Child of Our Time. And it's such an honour to perform along such fine musicians. Sian, of course, and Nick Jones. Nick and I have a connection from back in the very beginning of Short Black Opera, actually. The very first opera I wrote, Peak and Summer, I wrote a role for Nick in that opera, and he did perform it.
Really?
Exceptional musician. Teddy, as you mentioned, what a legend of Australian stages.
Extraordinary.
And I sing the soprano solo, and you heard a little bit in the excerpt you played earlier.
Yep.
I'd point people in the direction of, there are many fine recordings. Another one, favourite of mine, has Jesse Norman singing the soprano solo, something to aspire to there, and Janet Baker singing the alto, the mezzo-soprano part. Extraordinary recording. But talk about drama, this is such a dramatic work, and Michael Tippett really asks so much of both the performer and the listener, in a sense, to commit to a journey that takes you from the utter depths of despair, really, through to what is that final, what do we finally reach for in terms of a reconciliation, a point of resolution.
Because that whole work would have a particular meaning to you as well, wouldn't it? Because A Child of Our Time wasn't simply inspired by social injustice and persecution and conflict. It was written in the midst of all that going on as mm-hmm. well. And it continues to speak across the decades since it was written. And the time on which it was based is back in the 1939-ish.
That must resonate
with you.
Look, it does. And I think that's, I was listening to an interview with Simone Young last week, when Sydney Symph were releasing their 2026 program.
The program, that's right.
And she very proudly was talking about the new works that they're commissioning and championing. And I'm so very fortunate that I've worked with Sydney Symph a couple of times recently, a commission from them in Ghostlight and last year's New Morella concert, which has just come out on the ABC Classic label.
But we'll hear some of that in a few moments' time.
Fantastic. Yeah. But Simone was saying that a classic is something that really is proven after about 50 years. So we look at Tippett's work here, and it's definitely something that's embedded in the Western canon as a monumental work, such an important work, and to have around 500 voices in the choir singing alongside us. It does resonate, though, I think, because it is a classic. It is universal in its themes. Humanity at the moment is in such pain. There are those who seek to inflict pain. I think that's done out of an unresolved pain. But that's a much longer conversation and probably on a different show.
Yes,
but,
quite.
But I feel like this is a work, if you can make it along at 2 p.m. on Saturday to hear this work, you will be so uplifted through the process of of journeying from the collective experience through the personal experience to what is your response to the experience you're listening to. So
you've said in the past that you have a song for walking the dog, you've got a song for putting out the washing, a song for making the bed. How does all that the mundanities of life, how does that influence your approach to something as dramatic as the concert that you're about to sing in the Tippett work?
Well, look, I'm all constantly singing. Yes, I have a song for all those things and everything else besides. Not always the same song. I just feel like if we examine any day, we'll find ourselves, even if it's just in our minds, going through a thread of a melody or an earworm. Or for me, as a soprano, I have to let it out. I have to let it out. And so, you know, my wife will say, oh, she's singing again. In fact, probably more accurate would be, oh, you've stopped singing, because that would be the rare occurrence. But how it affects a performance like Saturday, I think that music is a constant thread in our life. And what one needs to do is to be able to grab hold of that thread and know what it is you want to say and be as truthful as you possibly can. And I think that that's what Tippett has achieved here. You know, it's rare these days, although I had an entire career as a soprano singing other composers' work. These days, and in the last decade, I've mostly sung works I've written myself. So it's a lovely invitation to come back and perform with the Sydney Philharmonic Choirs. And Brett Waymark is a genius.
He was here a couple of weeks ago, and I spoke to him about his propensity to sing the songs of the concert himself so that he understands what he's asking the performers to go through. Has he sung the work to you?
Absolutely. Today, Nick and I had a session, a rehearsal this morning. We were the only two of the solos who were able to be there this morning. So Brett just sang all the other parts with Tim at the piano.
Extraordinary, isn't it?
It is extraordinary, but I think he is a true servant of music, and that's what one must be to be able to get out of the way of it, actually, Alan. That's our job, to get out of the way of it and allow this monumental work to speak through us to an audience. And, you know, this is the beauty of music. You get to decide what your response is, and there's no pressure on you. That's what a concert hall can create for you, a space to come to your own understanding. And I think we need more of that in this world.
Well, talking about monumental works, I wanted to finish with perhaps one of the most monumental works with which you have been associated, and that is Umarala. We're listening to a little bit of it. Just tell us in a few brief words what that entire body of work means to you.
It was incredible to have a text that I'd written translated entirely into a language that only about five people could speak at the time it was translated, Gundi Chamara language. Mm-hmm. When I was composing this, and it's 19 movements long.
That's right.
19
it's
movements.
A long, long piece.
Depending on how fast the conductor takes it, it can be about 85 minutes of music. 19 movements, and as I was immersed in it over a period of about 18 months, I started to dream in Gundi Chamara language.
Really?
And it
really?
was a real turning point, Alan, to a language that I don't speak, I haven't studied, except in this context. Mm. And I felt like the ancestors of the Gundi Chamara people were guiding me along the way to write this in a truthful way and allow that process that a requiem will afford us to set souls free and to put to rest the unrest, I guess, that I felt on Gundi Chamara country. It's a war requiem that commemorates a resistance war that was fought in the 1800s, that apart from the Gunditjmara people and other Aboriginal communities of Victoria, very few people knew about.
Right.
And it's a very powerful way of sharing the story.
It is an extraordinarily powerful piece of music, and I've been privileged to play it, not all of it, but a lot of it during the Classical Beats program here on Eastside Radio. A Child of Our Time will be performed on this Saturday coming, that's the 13th of September, at the Sydney Opera House in the Concert Hall. It starts at 2 o'clock, but there's a speech by a friend of mine from Eastside Radio, from 2MBS Fine Music Sydney. There's a chat about it for half an hour prior to it. If tickets are still available, you'd do well to get hold of them. And you can do that at sydneyoperahouse.com. Professor Deborah Cheetham-Freylon, thank you so much for coming in and having a chat to us today, and very best wishes for the concert on Saturday.
Thanks so much, Alan.
You have been listening to Eastside Radio Podcast. For selections of more enjoyable content like this, visit our website, eastsidefm.org, and click on Podcast.